I used to work at a Starbucks here in Cardiff, and I've got to be honest, it's one of the better jobs I've ever had. The manager was brilliant, the other staff were nice and looked out for each other, so for a minimum-ish wage job, it was about as good as it gets. The only bad shifts to work were the first halves of Monday and Tuesday mornings, as the pre-work rush meant people were often at their absolute worst. I mean, don't get me wrong. People could be complete jerks at other times of the day or week, but the highest concentration of them was Monday and Tuesday mornings, without a shadow of a doubt. But rude customers aren't scary. Annoying and frustrating, yes. Chillingly cruel and calculating, not as much. Which is why this particular incident has stayed with me for so long, and I always seem to use it as my personal point of reference for how terrible human beings can be to each other. So, it's a Monday morning, and we're just coming to the end of the rush at around 9 a.m. 30 minutes more, and the caffeine fiends will start to thin out, and we can get some coffee and make a smoke break of our own. I heard her before I saw her. Like, she was only just trying to get a handle on what had been pure harpy screeches just moments before. Some woman was on her phone, ranting away and not looking where she was going as she tries to find the back of the queue. In doing so, she cuts off this other bloke who politely informs her that she's queue jumping. I don't know if she actually didn't hear him or was just tactically ignoring him, but either way, this bloke has to tap her on the shoulder before saying, "Excuse me, believe I was ahead of you." The woman just shrugs this off at first, giving the guy a gesture like, "I'm too busy to listen to you." I remember the look of anger on the guy's face as she gently but firmly grabs the strap of her handbag and tugs her out of the queue before taking her place. I'm a bit torn about the whole thing. Like, yeah, it was righteous, but laying hands on someone, I feel like there could have been a better way to resolve the issue. But it wasn't like the guy had picked her up and thrown her, and due to the size difference, that was definitely a possibility. Anyway, she reacts like this had been the case, like him actually standing up to her was some horrific incident of assault, and starts demanding someone call the police, even though she herself was on the phone and simply refused to hang up. A couple of staff members and customers manage to calm the situation down, and we get the guy his coffee before one of my colleagues serves the angry woman. I didn't serve her, but when she got her order, she turns to be like, excuse me, this coffee isn't as hot as I asked for." No, I know better than to just argue with customers and especially absolute whoppers like her. So I do as I'm asked and heat the coffee up a little bit more for her. I hand it back. She dips a finger in it and once again tells me, "This coffee isn't hot enough." Now bearing in mind, she just watched me run some steam through it, but again, I do as I'm asked and give her back some literally steaming hot coffee that she proceeds to absolutely overload with sugar. No wonder she was in such a stinking mood. Her entire life was probably one big sugar crash, hence why she was such an unbearable person to be around. But little did I realize, that coffee wasn't for her. And on her way out of the store, she took the lid off of her scalding hot syrupy coffee and threw it in the guy's face as he sat reading his newspaper. God, the sound of that guy screaming was absolutely horrific. Like I didn't actually see the woman throw her coffee in the guy's face, so I thought someone had broken a leg or something. That's the only time I've heard someone scream in pain like that. When my old skating buddy absolutely shattered his leg on this visit to a Bristol skate park one year. But what followed in the coffee shop was pure chaos. People were pouring bottles of water onto this guy's face, ambulance staff and police turning up. I think the woman legged it as soon as she threw the coffee because, to my knowledge, no one was arrested, but the guy who had the coffee thrown on him suffered life-changing injuries. From what another colleague told me, the gross amount of sugar in the coffee meant that some of it actually stuck to his face like a kind of molten hot glue. He'd been left with terrible scarring for the rest of his life, and all because he stood up to some absolute monster in the queue that morning. That's what I find really scary. That some people out there are so unhinged that a seemingly normal interaction with them could end up with you suffering injuries you'll carry with you for the rest of your life. Just one moment of misjudgment, one little enough is enough moment, and boom, you're going to look at a very different version of yourself in the mirror for the rest of your natural life. For the past few years or so, I've lived here in Redwood City, California. Back in 2008, some of you might remember that a Philadelphia branch of Starbucks asked two African Americans to leave because they hadn't bought anything. They were accused of racism, there was a whole bunch of fallout from it, and in the end, Starbucks announced that it would no longer ask anyone to leave their stores as long as they weren't causing a disturbance. From what I heard, this prompted a bunch of trouble with homeless people hanging around Starbucks outlets and generally making a nuisance of themselves, but I can't really speak to that because the only homeless guy that ever showed up in my local Starbucks was Steve. Steve was about as far from the stereotypical idea of a homeless person as you can imagine. I remember seeing him in relatively clean clothes, tapping away on a smartphone that was charging from a nearby power outlet, and not giving him a second glance. I walked in, got my coffee, and carried on my way to work. The next morning, Steve is there again, paper in front of him, tapping away on his smartphone. Only this time, as I'm in line waiting to give my order, I see him reaching for a grubby-looking backpack that seemed to contain all of his worldly possessions. It dawned on me that he didn't have a coffee in front of him, and when I thought about it, he didn't have one that day before either. And that's when I realized that Steve was in fact homeless. And it was then that I actually noticed how tired he looked, how the skin of his face was stretched around his eye sockets like he'd skipped one too many meals in his time. Steve was obviously taking advantage of Starbucks' new policy in order to get indoors and charge his phone, and although he was technically taking up the space of a paying customer, none who got an inkling of his living situation ever seemed to complain. This was until one day when Steve got himself into some kind of confrontation with a customer. I think maybe one of his bag straps was lying in the way of someone because I only looked up in time after hearing someone apologize. This big guy in a bad suit scoffed as he sat down close by, shaking his head. "Shouldn't even be here," the big guy said. I thought it was quite an obnoxious comment, but I'm far too much of an introvert to say anything about it. Steve tried to apologize again, but the guy started going off on him, telling him he shouldn't be there if he wasn't a paying customer. And in a display of kindness that'll stay with me for the rest of my life, the guy at the head of the line bought Steve a coffee and a red berry cheese Danish. "There, now he has something, so mind your business." It wasn't one of those "and then everyone clapped" moments. It was still incredibly awkward since no one wanted to get into a shouting match at that time in the morning, especially not me. So after the fat guy was shamed into silence, he just sort of wrapped his double smoked bacon and walked out, avoiding eye contact as he went. That's when I found out his name was Steve, and every morning after, if Steve was in the Starbucks, I'd always say hi and asked if he wanted a coffee or a red berry cheese. Some mornings he'd accept, some he'd decline, and I came to learn that he used the charger and the free Wi-Fi to look for a job. He wasn't a drug addict, he wasn't an alcoholic, he'd just fallen on hard times after a nervous breakdown and was slowly building himself back up and putting his life back together. Learning that is how me and a handful of other Starbucks regulars developed a great deal of affection for Steve after a while, but our regular cheery encounters with him somehow made it easier to forget that he slept under Redwood Junction every night, and I guess assuring ourselves that Steve would be okay meant we could just walk away and not worry about it. Because one Monday morning when I walked into the Starbucks and saw Steve's seat empty, I automatically assumed it was good news. Maybe he'd found a place to stay, or maybe he'd struck gold in his job search. And I found myself asking the barista if they'd heard anything from Steve over the weekend. To my absolute delight, he told me Steve had an interview at a local car wash. He wasn't sure exactly what day, he just knew that Steve had made the announcement the previous afternoon before departing the store. So, that was the end of seeing Steve on my morning Starbucks runs. I hoped that he might show up again, buying his own coffee, looking healthier and happier, but he didn't, and I guess that was just fine. But at the same time, I'd have been lying if I said I didn't kind of miss him. Like I might have mentioned, I'm a card-carrying introvert, but I do enjoy a sense of community. I still enjoy the comfort of familiar faces, so anyone who makes me comfortable enough to come out of my shell, I appreciate that more than I think I can even describe. So after a few weeks of not seeing Steve at all, I decided to take a walk down to some of the local car washes to see if I could spot Steve. First place I asked hadn't heard of him, neither had the second place. But the third car wash I tried said that they were hoping I was the one who could give them answers. You see, the third place I tried was indeed the same place Steve had an interview scheduled, but it was an interview he hadn't shown up for. I asked if he'd called ahead to cancel or anything, and the car wash boss said no, and that he just ghosted. And that's when I really started to worry. My concern for Steve's well-being grew to the point where I began to entertain the idea of going down to the Redwood Junction to look for him. I hope I don't sound too prejudiced when I say I found it an intimidating prospect. Like, as much as I appreciate that a lot of homeless people are just like Steve, good people who've fallen on hard times, I know that there are some people in the streets who are so broken that they do actually pose a danger to the general public. But as I said, my concern grew and grew until I didn't give good care if the sight of homeless people camp would upset my delicate sensibilities. A man's life was at stake. I needed to act. I wasn't sure I'd be able to live with myself otherwise. That was how I ended up cycling down to the junction one Saturday afternoon, where I began nervously giving descriptions of Steve and asking if people had seen him. People mostly shook their heads at me, looking at me like I'd grown an extra nose or something. I guess having visitors to the camp wasn't exactly a common occurrence. Time and time again, I was met with the same response. A shrug, a shake of the head, complete indifference. At least until I spoke to one much older guy who wore a Vietnam veteran baseball cap and a grimy old fatigue jacket. This guy seemed a little bit more with it than some of the other homeless folks, and although he had the distinct smell of marijuana about him, he was lucid enough to get a straight answer from. After confirming we were talking about the same Steve, this vet told me that he knew him well, but that he hadn't been around the junction in a few days. When I pressed him for where Steve might have gone, the vet shrugged, but told me Steve had left behind a bunch of his belongings. According to him, this could be a good thing just as much as a bad thing. When some homeless folks find a way off the street, either moving back in with family or getting a place in a program somewhere, they leave behind all their stuff. Some just don't need it anymore. A tent and a sleeping bag are useless when you have a room and a bed. But others find that the stuff they had on the street just reminds them of a time they'd rather just forget about. But sometimes, leaving all their stuff behind meant something bad had happened. I could see the worry just etched into the vet's face, and he seemed to be racking his brain for a moment before an idea struck him. He mentioned that Steve used to bring food to a girl who stayed on the other side of the camp, and that maybe she'd know where he was. Up until talking to that girl, my time at the camp had been unexpectedly uplifting. Sure, seeing people living like that was upsetting, but seeing how nice some of them were, how they hadn't let their hardships break them down, seeing them purely as the human beings they are, I have to say, it was quite cathartic. Yet the visit to the girl's tent was the point at which the trip became more terrifying than I ever imagined it could be. As we approached the girl's tent, the vet greeted someone nearby and asked if a person called Mouse was home. They nodded, but added that she wasn't doing too good. I wasn't sure what they meant by that, but on seeing this Mouse girl curled up in a fetal position in her tent, I was almost certain it was drug-related. The vet gently shook the girl awake, and I'm pretty sure she was high from the way she lazily opened her eyes and how out of it she seemed. But then as soon as the guy mentioned Steve's name, the girl shoots wide open, and she gives him this terrified look before saying, I told him not to go. I told him not to, but he didn't listen. Now he's gone. The vet asks her where. Where did she tell Steve not to go? She replies with, the cemetery, before bursting into tears. The last question we could get her to answer was what happened at the cemetery for Steve to be gone. She replied with, it took him. it. Not he or they. It. Hearing that word used like that caused this sinking feeling in my stomach. Not so much because of what it entailed, but because this girl was so messed up over what happened, and that obviously meant bad news for Steve. Before leaving the camp, I asked the vet what cemetery Mouse could have been talking about. I had my own idea of which one she was referring to, I just wanted to see if he had the same answer, and he did. He said he'd bet his last dime that she was talking about the historic Union Cemetery on Woodside Road. And I agreed, because the historic Union Cemetery is right across the street from the hand car wash where Steve was scheduled to have his interview. I took all this information to the police, telling them I was a friend of Steve's before I had them file a missing persons report. I made sure to record the reference number I was giving, as I'd be able to use it to get in touch with whatever detectives would eventually be assigned to the case, I assumed. I tried all throughout that next week to get the relevant cops on the phone, but it seemed to take forever before the case was properly assigned. In the meantime, I thought I'd take a ride down to the cemetery to see if anything caught my eye. I don't really know what I was planning on doing. It's not like I knew anything about being a detective, but at the same time, I couldn't just sit on my butt and do nothing. So, for those of you that don't know, Redwood City's historic Union Cemetery isn't really a cemetery. It did actually function as one until about 1919 or so, but after that it basically became a kind of memorial. From what I can remember, some Civil War soldiers are buried there along with a few famous pioneers, so it's more for tourists and sightseers than grieving families or funeral processions. While walking up and down the gravel paths and checking out the old graves, it occurred to me that when the girl said, like, Steve is in the cemetery, it might have been her way of telling us that he was dead. There was every chance we just totally misinterpreted that, and I was in that cemetery on a complete fool's errand, wasting my time looking for something I wouldn't find. And if that's the case, what I found and saw next is completely irrelevant, and is naturally to be disregarded. But, and a big but here, if it is connected to the Steve disappearance, it raises questions that honestly don't bear thinking about. So, as I said, I'm walking down this gravel path, and a handful of people I see are just all checking out the statues, taking pictures, and all that other stuff. Only, I see this one guy, all by his lonesome, and he's walking with purpose, with a plastic bag in his hand. When I say walking with purpose, I mean like, he wasn't there just to hang around and check out the memorials. He was walking fast, like he wanted in and out in as short a time as possible. Just the sight of him filled me with curiosity, but it's not like if I rushed after him, he wouldn't freak out. So as much as I tried my best to follow him, he slipped away from my view almost as quickly as he had appeared. Only he'd left something behind, the white plastic bag having just dumped it behind one of the bleach-white tombstones, apparently in the hopes that it would remain hidden from public view. At first, I was just mad, like who leaves their trash in a graveyard or whatever. But I went to check out what the bag contained. It just looked like a bunch of organ meat. Like I 100% saw something dark enough to be liver in there, and some of the other pieces looked like chunks of white fat. It smelled real bad too, like he might have been hanging on to it for a couple of days before he'd left it there. To this day, it's probably one of the weirdest things to ever happen to me. Finding a bag of meat like that, just abandoned in the middle of a ceremonial cemetery. And like I said, whether or not it's even remotely connected to Steve's disappearance is anyone's guess. I mean, the detectives treated me like I was crazy when I brought it up with them in the weeks that followed. They'd sent some beat cops out to the cemetery and they hadn't found a thing. But I also know they seemed totally clueless in their investigation, like they either didn't care about it or just couldn't get a lead anywhere. And that's just how things went. I get in touch every so often, only to be told the investigator hadn't progressed anywhere. It didn't help that it had taken weeks for anyone to report him missing, and the fact that it was me that should have acted earlier gave me this horrendous sense of guilt for the longest time. Steve had no family out here, and I barely knew anything about him. The best I could do was share the few slivers of info I had with the cops, then just hope it came to something. But it came to nothing, and now Steve is just one more name on the missing persons register, a missing persons register that stretches a mile long. The rate at which homeless people go missing around Redwood City is considerably higher than the surrounding areas, and given how difficult it is to conduct any kind of census or research among the homeless, that figure could be even higher than the numbers suggest. The trouble is, people just don't care. Even people who purport to care about social justice are content to focus their attentions on ridiculous niche topics when homeless people are dying and disappearing on the streets of California every single day. I don't know what's going on out here. Whether or not it's just fentanyl killing people off, some kind of serial killer, or something less explainable. But something is killing homeless people at a totally disproportionate rate. And all kinds of other weird stuff is going on to boot. I just pray that whatever it is can be identified and stopped before more people like Steve are lost. People who try so hard to tread water, only to end up slipping beneath the waves. At around 5:15 a.m. on the morning of July 6, 1997, a Starbucks employee arrived at work to open up the Wisconsin Avenue Northwest branch of the world-famous coffee company, situated just north of Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. There was a lot of work to be done before the morning rush, and the employee in question had yet to imbibe their morning espresso to really kick them into gear. So, by their own admission, they were pretty groggy by the time they headed out back to one of the freezer units, intending to fetch some of the breakfast pastries that would go on sale that morning. But when the overtired staff member cracked open the freezer unit, they saw something that made their heart race. Inside was the frozen, lifeless corpse of 25-year-old night manager Mary Katrin Mahoney, along with the bodies of 18-year-olds Emery Allen Evans and Aaron David Goodrich. Although they weren't always on the same shift pattern, the employees knew his slain co-workers well, and the horror of witnessing their frozen, discolored cadavers was almost too much to bear. They raced out of the Starbucks and flagged down a bus driver who was only just beginning his morning route, and given how they could have just called 911 from the on-site telephone, running to find the comfort of another living person is very telling of this person's distraught state of mind. Within 5 minutes of the initial 911 call, police were on scene and taking stock of the situation. All three employees had obviously been herded into the rear freezer units before being shot, execution style. But what initially confused the investigation was that not a single cent was missing from the Starbucks. If the motivation wasn't robbery, then it looked a lot like a brutally well-executed targeted killing. But why on earth would someone ambush and murder three coffee shop employees during their routine night shift? What made the murders all the more shocking was that Georgetown has been traditionally a low-crime area of Washington, D.C., with local district council member Jack Evans saying, "To have a triple homicide anywhere in the District of Columbia is an unusual event, but to have a triple homicide in Georgetown is extraordinary, and this has never been a place where crime has been a problem." Over the course of that balmy July morning, scores of blue-uniformed officials made their way to the scene to look for evidence outside the split-level brown brick store. Homicide detectives and forensic technicians alike pored over the scene for hours on end after the bodies were found, working inside and outside the building adorned with the familiar green and black logo. They dusted doors for fingerprints, searched the store, and took statements from local residents in the hopes of piecing together what had happened. But it was only when Mary Mahoney's car was examined that further evidence was found, evidence which indicated that the murders were no random attack. Inside, the car was spotless, save for what looked like signs that Mahoney had recently spent time playing with a pet, a dirty tennis ball, a plastic chew toy, a dog's brush, and a red towel. The only possible indication that something had gone awry was a flat tire on the front passenger side of the car, evidence that her attacker had made provisions to prevent her from fleeing. "Mary was special," her mother later said. "She had an enormous heart. She probably would have compassion for the person who killed her." When she moved to Washington several years prior, Mary would jog alone an hour before daybreak, never worrying about being attacked or assaulted. She adored animals, particularly horses, and even took in Marlou, her sister Molly's toothless black and white alley cat. She attended various New York colleges before graduating with honors from Towson State University near Baltimore, and was a loyal and active Democrat interning for Bill Clinton when he was first elected. Yet according to her mother, it was her managerial job at Starbucks that really excited Mary. She had been employed by the company for 2 years and enjoyed being the manager. She was often seen sweeping the sidewalk in front of the store, and obviously took pride in her store. What she didn't enjoy, though, was disciplining employees, particularly one that Mary had recently dismissed for allegedly stealing several $100s. She struggled with the issue before having to fire him, her mother said, and for a long time, this became homicide detectives' main theory regarding the Starbucks shootings. Yet despite their hard work and determination, they came up short at every turn, eventually turning to the televisual law enforcement institution that is America's Most Wanted. After picking the case up, America's Most Wanted staged a thorough recreation of the murders and detailed many of the theories that police were toying with. They also advertised the number of an anonymous hotline, pleading with those with any information to come forward. And it seems this appeal struck a nerve with one member of the public, who called in with not only a frightening piece of information, but also a rather courageous proposal. In the hours following the broadcast of the Starbucks shootings, a woman called into America's Most Wanted hotline to inform them that she was dating a man who actually knew the shooter firsthand. This mystery person had confessed, even boasted, of committing the murders, and on more than one occasion. The couple had initially taken the man's word as pure bluster, but after seeing the Starbucks shooting edition of America's Most Wanted, it became apparent that he might just be telling the truth. The woman then left her name and numbers so she could be contacted by DC police, and when they did so, she actually agreed to wear a wire for them, in the hopes that she could catch a confession on tape. It was then that they learned their suspect's name, Carl D. Cooper. Cooper lived in Prince George's County near Baltimore City and just on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. itself. He was the son of a church deacon who lived with his wife and son, but at the time, he lived anything but the wholesome life of a family guy. At the time of the Starbucks shooting, Cooper was being charged with attempted murder in a 1996 shooting of an off-duty police officer in Prince George County. As for his family's complicity in his crimes, it turned out that it was Cooper's wife that purchased the 9mm handgun that her husband used to shoot the officer. It was the combination of this and his alleged involvement in the Starbucks shooting that led DC police to wiretap Cooper's home phone. He was arrested after making reference to several local shootings, but insisted that a friend of his named Keith Covington had joined him in the Starbucks robbery, and it was him that executed the three victims. However, when they caught up with Covington, they discovered he had been recovering from a gunshot wound at the time of the murder, meaning it was highly unlikely that he was even present on the scene, let alone the one to have done the shooting. "If I killed them, I'd say I killed them," he reportedly said. "But that's not me. I'm not saying I'm a saint, but I'm not going to go out and just kill people. You gotta be a dummy or a psycho to do something like that. It's pure evil." When confronted with the evidence of his lies, Cooper admitted to lying about his so-called friend's involvement because he killed three people and was afraid to go to jail. In the process of trying to avoid the death penalty, Cooper told the investigators he'd been staking out the Starbucks for about a month, confirming that he acted alone and fired two guns, a .38 caliber snub-nosed revolver and a .38 caliber pistol. Cooperating heavily due to the ever-looming threat of the death penalty, Cooper confessed to shooting the manager, Mary Mahoney, when she refused to give him keys to the safe, which held over $10,000 in cash. When she said no, Cooper shot a warning shot into the ceiling, which sent a terrified Mahoney running into the employee hall. Cooper pursued, caught her, and wrestled with Mahoney over her keys. But when her resistance looked like it would be too much to overcome, he shot her dead. He then shot the two other Starbucks workers at the store, executing one as they survived the attack and attempted to crawl to safety. Cooper later stated that he wanted to put him out of his pain and misery, but it's more than likely this thinly veiled attempt at showing he had a conscience was nothing but an attempt to dodge the first death penalty charge in over 30 years. During his trial, even when the relatives of the victims wept openly in court, Cooper remained chillingly composed. He also admitted to murdering a 39-year-old security guard named Sandy Griffin during a botched robbery. Cooper had helped Griffin at gunpoint before demanding that the security guard hand over their expensive 40-caliber handgun. But then, fearing Griffin would assault him in the process to defend herself, the serial murderer executed the security guard before quickly fleeing the scene. Cooper admitted to then selling the pistol on the street for $300. Once Cooper was convicted of the Starbucks murders and sentenced to life in prison, Griffin's relatives were no doubt pleased that their loved one's killer had been put away, but they expressed frustration that it had taken three more murders, maybe even more, before the killer had been caught. To them, a lack of urgency in the DC police force had cost three young people their lives and raised many questions regarding their competence and command. If the account of his defense attorney is to be believed, Cooper is nothing more than a career criminal whose shaky temperament and unbridled greed caused him to take the lives of the innocent. But time and time again, Cooper had the opportunity to simply take the money and walk away. Yet he chose not to. He chose to kill people he just didn't need to kill, and he did this on more than one occasion. The first time might have been down to a simple rush of blood to the head, and it's a genuine possibility that killing the security guard was not part of Cooper's plans. But there's also a possibility that killing him proved to be something of a thrill that Cooper wanted to replicate in executing the three Starbucks workers.